I call this meeting of the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law to order. I think we have a quorum. Quorum is present. May I have a motion from Representative Engen to approve the minutes from Tuesday, March 11th?
That is my motion, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Engen. All those in favor of approving the minutes from Tuesday, March 11th, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the motion prevails and the minutes are approved.
Mr. Chair, you should probably ask for discussion first.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate
Welcome,
that.
Welcome, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so our first bill is going to be HF 1027. Representative West is going to be presenting this bill. We will be laying over the bill today. Representative West, seeing as how you are not a member of this committee, I will go ahead and, well, we're laying it over. So I see there's an A1 author's amendment. Would you like the committee to adopt the amendment and then proceed with your presentation?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I will move your bill to get it before the committee for the purpose of laying it over. Explain your author's amendment.
The author's amendment. So this bill is a product of a lot of work, many hours in my office. So many hours I had to leave and have my good friends here hash out more details in my office in my absence. We had a little mishap last year with a committee referral, but this year we are in the right place. So this amendment is kind of the last bit of discussion that what was taking place between all interested parties. And if I could explain again, he can clarify.
Please state your name for the record and offer your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. And this amendment does three things. It the first on page 2, line 22 amendment or 1.2 of the amendment. It would provide additional protection so that homeowners who might be entitled to the surplus actually get notice that they have the right to do that and make the claim. So it increases notice. The second amendment regarding the sheriff, the sheriff was, under the bill, the sheriff was in a position to actually kind of make almost adjudicatory decisions, which they really weren't prepared to make, nor should they be put in the position to make, and this addresses that. And the third adds a 30 days to the ability of a homeowner to redeem. So it's a positive, it's a good for the notice, it's good for the sheriff, and it's good for homeowners. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is there any member discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, please state so by saying aye. Those opposed, the amendment is adopted. We now have the bill in the shape the author would like. Representative West, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, as I said, House File 1027 was born last year, brought to me by a concerned sheriff and what to do with the surpluses they have. We worked on, engaged with Legal Aid to make sure that the bill addresses all parties concerned and the Real Estate Division of the Bar to make sure everyone is on the same page, and the bill does exactly what we wish it to do. So in case of a foreclosure, when there are competing claims, when they put a bid on the property, there can be a surplus, and that surplus the sheriff has to figure out how to deal with. And without this bill, it has been very difficult for the sheriffs to determine what they should do, who is entitled to it, who should be paid. There is also the concern of a lot of people who are being foreclosed on may be completely unaware that there is a surplus that they have a that they may have a right to if there's no lien holder. So what we've seen in the past is in these situations, sheriffs attempt to do it correctly, but they literally have paid the wrong people inadvertently and lost lawsuits as a result. So it's been a cost to our counties. This gives them clarity and also informs people of their rights, so it also has consumer protection benefits. And that's a great addition to the bill that we've worked on with Legal Aid. And I'll turn it over to my testifier to do a quick technical overview so that the committee is aware of the contents of the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative West. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Chair and members, my name is Colleen Daly. I'm an attorney at Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid and have worked a lot in the foreclosure arena. And the bill, basically, from our perspective, one of the most important things the bill does is it when somebody, so let's say you're in foreclosure, you owe $50,000 on your house, there's a sheriff sale. Sometimes if you have a lot of equity, outside bidders come, they might bid $100,000. So all of a sudden there's a $50,000 surplus. But in the past, the homeowners might not even know that that surplus exists. That's one problem. Another problem is if the homeowner wants to redeem, so they have a six-month period to redeem, meaning if they can come up with the money that was bid at the sheriff sale, they get to keep the house, or at least they get to keep the equity. So oftentimes people will sell their house as a way to redeem, so they get to capture any equity in the house. And so the bill also now creates a situation where homeowners can use that surplus and apply it to their redemption. So instead of having to come up with the $100,000 that was bid at the sale, they have to only come up with $50,000 because there's a $50,000 surplus there waiting for them. So that's a big part of what the bill does. And then it clarifies who gets paid with the surplus, because the law is really not very clear on who gets paid first in terms of the homeowner, or if there's other lien holders. So there might be a second mortgage, there might be some other kind of lien on the property. And so the bill clarifies when there is a surplus, so when more is bid on the property than is what's owing, who gets that surplus. And it provides notice, to the homeowner. It also creates a process whereby junior lien holders, so any lien holders that come after the one that's foreclosing, have a process to make a claim. So they have to make a claim to the sheriff's office to say, hey, I'm entitled to some of the surplus, and they have to explain why that is. And then if there's competing claims, and it's not clear to the sheriff who's entitled to the money, there's a process for the sheriff to initiate a court proceeding for the court to determine who has priority and who should get the money, if it's between the homeowner or different, if there's multiple lien holders, or if there's dispute or confusion about who's owed the money, there's the sheriff can initiate a court proceeding for that to be clarified. And again, the homeowner can make a request to have the surplus applied to the redemption, which is what I explained earlier. If there's a very small surplus, it just goes, if it's under $100, it just goes to the homeowner regardless, because it's such a small amount, there's really no reason to fight over it. I think that is about the... It also does clarify another point that, so in Minnesota, so we have a law that says that if someone's in foreclosure and they apply for a loan modification, so the way to resolve if you're behind on your loan, you go to your lender and say, help me modify my loan so I don't lose my house. And under the law, if someone applies, the foreclosure cannot go forward. And there's been some confusion as to whether the foreclosing party has to completely stop the foreclosure process or whether they can just postpone the sheriff's sale if somebody applies for a loan modification while the foreclosure is in process. So we also clarified that, saying that they can postpone instead of having to start all over, but they also have to give the homeowner some, it lengthens the amount of time then that they cannot have the sale until 30 days have passed from the point that they've been denied a loan modification, basically, or there's been a determination that they're not entitled to one, or the homeowner doesn't proceed timely for the application. So it basically, there's a lot of protections in here for homeowners, and it helps the sheriffs because it clarifies what they should be doing.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Do we have another testifier? Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Eric Cook, last name is C-O-O-K, and yes, I've been actively involved with the representative here in drafting and the policy issues involved in this bill. And we've heard quite a bit about the surplus aspect already from the legal aid folks, which they've generously helped craft and fine-tune to protect some of the stakeholders. But truly, there really are about three individual areas that this bill seeks to improve on. And I should point out that it's really about improving the process, not changing substantive law. Because what we have here are very fine-tuned processes that can all happen very, very quickly, and sometimes people without notice don't find out about their rights. Or what we've run into in recent 10, 20 years, ever since the recession of the Great Recession of 2008, is we have what we call bottom feeders, or the more neutral term is foreclosure speculators. People that are looking to take the equity from a homeowner's house instead of that equity going back to the homeowner or to legitimate creditors of that homeowner. So some of what we're trying to talk about here today is changing the process to kind of smooth out the process, make it more fair, more transparent, to make sure that everybody has time to protect their own rights. So in addition to everything that's been discussed about surpluses, lots of good things in there to help the homeowners and to help junior creditors with valid claims. We also are dealing with redemption fraud. Again, this is where the foreclosure speculators come in and are looking to insert themselves into the process where they have no other interest in this property, no other relationship to the homeowner, and yet they see, by just researching, you know, Zillow.com and the real property records, that, hey, there's probably some equity in this property. This is their profit motive. And what we're trying to do is minimize those opportunities here. And then, as Ms. Daly mentioned, and the loss mitigation process, we want to make this a more fair process so that lenders can design a process around loss mitigation and loan modifications, which has become such an important tool nowadays to avoid foreclosures. Full candor, I represent generally the mortgage lenders that are doing the foreclosure of homes, but even for the lenders, we want to see a fair process, one that is balanced and that gives everybody an opportunity to do what is right. So with respect to the surplus, one key point here is that if there is a surplus that's greater than $100, this gives the sheriff the mandate to hold on to those funds. Right now, the statute gives no time limits. It's entirely silent as to how long the surplus funds are held on to or who to disperse them to. This specifically says that the sheriff shall hold on to them for the length of the homeowner's redemption period, which in 95% of the cases is 6 months after the foreclosure sale. So it gives everybody a lot of time to figure out who does that surplus go to. And some of the counties were starting to impose these kind of conditions. They would say, let's hold on to them for 120 days. Or Washington County, in a couple instances, was requiring that the funds be held on to for the full 6 months. So what we're doing is essentially proposing to codify these timelines and give everybody an opportunity to make sure the correct person gets access to the surplus. I know that there's been some mention of this case that happened in Carver County, I believe, where there was a surplus of $63,000, and the sheriff, in error, just an honest mistake, paid that money over to the homeowner, and yet there was a junior mortgage in favor of a lender, I believe it was Wells Fargo. So Wells Fargo came in and got a judgment against Carver County, and Carver County was personally responsible, or the county had to pay that judgment, plus a 20% penalty, because there's a statute that says that's the penalty for the sheriff making that mistake. So what we're doing here should help protect sheriffs, in addition to homeowners. With respect to the creditor redemptions and creditor fraud, there's been a process in place for junior creditors from, I suppose, all the way back to the 1800s, where it's a very quick process. After the six-month redemption period expires, you have these quick little windows. It used to be 5 days, where each creditor, in the order of their priority, comes in and makes their claim to redeem from the property. They have to pay the foreclosing lender any money that was bid at the sale, plus any other junior creditor that redeemed ahead of them. And in quick succession, you got to make the right decision. You got to figure out how much money you pay. You got to record the right documents. You got to do it in one case within 24 hours of you completing your redemption. And there's all kinds of litigation that has arisen over people just missing their deadlines. Myself personally, I've been involved in at least three or four of these cases where I'm trying to protect my clients who have made those honest mistakes. So what one aspect of this is to not only change those creditor windows from 7 days to 14 days, but also give creditors a 7-day window instead of a 4-day window in which to get their certificates of redemption recorded. And in this modern day, sometimes the sheriffs have done a better job of policing the party's rights, and it's been hard to get that certificate of redemption immediately on the day of effecting the redemption. So this gives everybody more time to do their research, make sure they're doing the right thing. So I think this is a really important part of this bill, is to afford valuable time to the parties to make the right decisions. A real small piece of it is to be precise when calculating redemption amounts, whether it's for a homeowner redeeming or a junior creditor seeking to redeem after the homeowner's redemption period. So if there are advances made during that redemption period, say for advancing property taxes, property insurance, improving the property, protecting it from waste, the redeeming creditor has to state a specific date on which they incurred those charges so that the correct redemption amount can be calculated at the interest rate that's stated on their debt. So both the specific date, and the interest rate all need to be specified under these amendments. Maybe just briefly on the loss mitigation standpoint, although Ms. Daly adequately covered big parts of it, is to create additional lender flexibility when there is a request from a homeowner for loss mitigation. See, there's a lack of clarity in the statute as to what does it mean when a homeowner has submitted a request for loss mitigation. And there is equal lack of clarity as to when does a lender have to halt their foreclosure and help evaluate this loss mitigation process. And what this statute does is gives the lender the ability to postpone a sale, a foreclosure sale that's already been scheduled, or cancel it entirely if they think, all right, we got a complete application, we're ready to act on it. But what's happened here is under federal law, under RESPA, there's a similar process that's going, and there's an inconsistency between state and federal law here. So lenders have struggled knowing, what do you do? Do you have to cancel the sale? And there's a big downside for the homeowner in that instance, because the lender has already incurred a few thousand dollars in attorney's fees and costs to publish in a legal newspaper. And if they feel they're at risk of violating the dual tracking provisions in Chapter 582, they'll cancel that sale. All of the costs they incurred are recoverable against the homeowner, who may want to save their house after a second attempt at a foreclosure if loss mitigation fails. So it gets more expensive for the homeowner just because the lender is needing to be conservative and protect the homeowner's rights. So this amendment that gives that lender more flexibility is a good provision. It's going to help smooth out the process, which is really kind of the theme here today. It's not changing substantive law. It's improving the process for all of the stakeholders involved. And then one final bit is, I think part of the amendment that was just passed here today was to increase from 30 days to 60 days the amount of time that needs to pass from the end of loss mitigation and the time that a foreclosure sale can go. And that's actually a good process for everybody. What happens is Minnesota has a dual tracking prohibition statute that says a lender cannot go down two paths at the same time. You cannot proceed with a foreclosure sale, and at the same time you're over here working with the borrower to see if you can qualify them for loss mitigation. So we can only do one at a time. So once you're in this loss mitigation process, the homeowner is submitting an application, their income, their expenses, trying to say, yes, I qualify, I want my loan modified. And let's say that they lost their job, maybe for the second time, or they had medical issues in their family, and they just aren't able to qualify for a program without any income. Well, they're going to get a notice, a denial letter from the lender at some point. They'll have a 30-day appeal period, usually under most lender programs. And then the foreclosure sale can proceed after that. Well, we found in practice that sometimes that denial letter and the expiration of the appeal happens on, say, day one, and 2 to 3 weeks later, you already have a sheriff's sale happening. So what we've done is we've created the separation between the end of loss mitigation and the continuation of the foreclosure that may give the homeowners maybe one final opportunity to refinance, borrow money from their 401ks or whatever it is. So it creates a more deliberate process that I think is a better balance of everybody's interests in these situations. So in all, to kind of sum up, this is good for lenders, this is good for homeowners, it's good for the sheriffs and pretty much all the stakeholders, and I strongly support this bill and hope you will too.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else in the audience wishing to weigh in on this bill? If so, you can come to the testifiers table. Seeing no one, we will go to member questions. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative West, for bringing this great bill. I'm pleased to be a co-author. I was having flashbacks to my property tax forfeiture bill from last year, and it was like, ooh. It seems like a lot of the same issues with different players and no complicated constitutional issues, which is good because that makes it easier. But just wanted to say that I strongly support this bill. I think bills like this where all the stakeholders come together and really like do that detailed, difficult work of figuring out how everyone's interests can be met are just the best kind of bills. So I am grateful to vote yes. Thanks.
Thank you. Any other member questions or comments? Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you. And I just echo that. And thank you for bringing this, Representative West, and doing the work. I just wanted to ask Mr. Cook, I didn't catch who you represent or where you're from, if you could just tell us that.
Mr. Cook.
Sure, yeah, for sure. Madam Chair, I'm a foreclosure attorney for the last 34 years. I work with Wilford, Geske, and Cook, which is here located in the Twin Cities. We've been in the downtown areas. We're currently in the suburbs, but we've been doing this since the 1960s.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you for that, and thank you for getting engaged, and thanks for everybody working on this. I mean, it sounds like a really good bill, and happy to support it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other member questions, comments? Seeing none, with that, the bill is laid over. Thank you, Representative West, for being here and to the testifiers.
Don't let it get lost. Let's make sure.
We won't.
Finds its way to the finish line.
We will not.
And Chair Latz in the Senate, Chair of Judiciary, is a co-author as well.
Okay, so, good to know.
Well
thank
done.
You. Thank you, thank you. Our next bill is Representative Feist. Make yourself taller. Thanks for making the move from one chair to the other and within the room here. You have House File 101. Would you like to move the bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. House File 101 before the committee.
Okay. And Representative Feist, do we have an amendment? It looks like we have a DE amendment. Would you like to move the DE and DE1?
I move the DE1 before the committee. This was to address the technical confusion that you identified, so thank you. And it basically, it was confusing formatting, so the DE doesn't change how the bill functions. It just reorganizes section 1332 a little bit for clarity.
All right. Any member discussion on the DE1? If not, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? Nay. The amendment is adopted. And just so you know, the motion is to have this re-referred to the Committee on Education Policy. So go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this bill is a really simple bill. It just expands the privacy protections that we created in 2023 with a bill by Chair Becker Finn. And it expands those protections from students to include parents. And it's to address this issue where predatory schools are reaching out to students and families with, like, fake scholarships. And there's just a lot of that going on. And so we wanted to make the family unit private data. And I have talked with Matt Ealing, and he is fine with this additional tweak on the legislation from last term. And with that, I will turn it over to my expert.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dozeland, and I'm here today representing, on behalf of various education organizations representing school superintendents, school boards, et cetera. And I'd like to thank Representative Feist for her authorship of the bill and for you hearing the bill, Madam Chair. We support this bill because it does clarify the changes that were made in 2023 regarding student directory information. However, parent directory information was not included in those protections, so this bill just seeks to align those privacy protections. The bill will remove any confusion that our school districts have about what information is to be kept private. However, we are seeking a limited exception to allow school districts the option to provide parent directory information for school referendum campaigns. While districts would not have to disclose that information upon request, they could have a policy to say they are not going to disclose it. If they choose to do so, that directory information must be available to any registered eligible campaign committee, whether it's a vote yes or a vote no campaign committee. We believe this provision will promote transparency, fairness, and consistency in how school districts manage parent directory information regarding those requests. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Feist. I remember our discussion on the underlying bill from last biennium. This is good stuff, really protects families. I appreciate it on it. My question either could go to our panel here or perhaps nonpartisan, but I'm just sort of thinking of some real world examples in recent history where there could be employees of schools who have potentially may or may not through the course of their work have access to student information and then parent information. And I'm curious if this bill would help limit some of that personal data of parents to employees of schools.
Representative Feist.
I think I will turn it over to Mr. Hopkins, but I don't think so. This is really about external parties having access, Chair Becker Finn gave a good example of like fake scholarships where kids are lured to educational institutions that aren't in their best interest, and actually they don't get scholarships and then just end up going into debt. So I think it's really about that more than school staff, but maybe Mr. Right. Hopkins can clarify.
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, representatives, so the bill, by classifying parent contact information as private, would limit its dissemination to outside parties. Government entities also have an obligation not to allow access to protected information to employees that don't have a justifiable employment-based reason for accessing it. So that's a general protection for private data that exists in the Government Data Practices Act.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you all for your input on that. I know that there was a really alarming story that happened in the East Metro. I won't get into the details of that, but occasionally, unfortunately, there are bad actors who are employed by schools and end up having access to information on students and or their families. Well, obviously we need to protect that information from the public and outside. Perhaps this committee might think about, for further discussion, how we might delicately work to protect information from maybe employees who don't need to access it directly through the scope of their work. Just because the case I'm referencing has to do with somebody who was arrested on significant child pornography
charges, and that's ongoing, so I won't get too much more into that. But just, you know, something for this committee maybe to consider. If it's not this bill, perhaps we continue some work on that.
Thank you, Representative Kern. I believe it's already against the law to release improperly that information, but that's, we can have a discussion on that another day. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Feist, I'm just curious, breaking my rule here about asking questions you have no idea what the answers are, but what you said, you mentioned twice now this fake scholarship problem, and I'm just curious about how the data is going out to people providing fake scholarships and like scammy kind of things, but how does the data go out to, you know, real scholarships, real offers, right? Like, what's the distinction there that we're making? I'm just curious because I wasn't offered any scholarships, so I don't know how that works.
True confessions. Representative Feist.
Yeah, I know that the original legislation, which we didn't change this aspect of it, made sure that I believe, and Mr. Hopkins can correct me because this is off the top of my head, but I believe the College Board, like, and I know for sure I worked with DEED last term to make sure that they have some programming for students who are graduating and can be eligible for some additional programming around jobs, that they had access. And actually, this is what Mr. Ealing told me. I told this to Chair Beckerfin too, that once you do this, then the question will be forever, like, well, who should have access, which led to our additional question about, like, school levies. And so, so that will be just an ongoing conversation. The goal was to make this data more protected to address that issue, but, you know, we've already expanded it once to, like, allow for DEED, and I believe, like, College Board does have access to this data, and Mr. Hopkins can correct me, and if not, like, I assume that's not an issue because it would have been addressed the original bill.
We can ask Mr. Hopkins because not only is he staffing this committee, but he staffs higher ed.
Oh, great.
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Finke, usually if a student gets an affirmative, like, reach out about a scholarship, it's because they've given consent through some place to let people know that they're interested in getting these kinds of scholarships. So it's either because they've given consent to be contacted about those kinds of things.
Representative, thank you.
Thank you for that. And, you know, because that's one of the things that I think about, you know, not to go more true confessions, but, like, I scraped through, you know, and barely, you know, got out and to the places I wanted to go. And this is also, like, in addition to being a privacy issue, it's also, it seems like a real scam issue, right? And taking advantage of people who may not be expecting scholarships, right? Like, really targeting those individuals. So I just appreciate this and want to make sure that we continue to recognize those other barriers that folks are showing. Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, I know we have a member of this body that is a photographer that does senior portraits, and he used to get this information to send out information like, hey, you're going to be a senior. Are you interested in get your senior photos taken? So there are a lot of other, you know, other reasons that information has been public and how others have, you know, other businesses or whatever have used it. And I mean, you know, you might legitimately want to know, hey, who are the photographers for getting senior pictures taken? So there are some of those issues that have to be taken into consideration. Our next question is Representative Steer.
Okay, thank you, Chair. So this is completely out of my wheelhouse. I'm doing as much research as I can on the fly, so correct me if I'm wrong, but does this cover 20 U.S. Code 1232H as well? You have G listed in there, and the H would be addressing pupil rights, prohibiting students from being required to submit surveys that would touch into political affiliations, mental or psychological problems, or sexual behavior. Wondering if H is covered on there as well and if it's a good idea to add H.
Representative Feist.
You said 20 USC? Is like a Department of Labor regulation?
So it's a U.S. You have in your own, so in line 1.18 U.S. State Code Title 20 Section 1232G and Code of Federal Regulations. So then when I look that up, then it's 20 U.S. Code 1232H, which covers that the students or pupils wouldn't be able to, or that they wouldn't have to submit surveys that would show political affiliations, mental or psychological problems, or sexual behavior. I think that if that would fit in this bill.
Representative Feist.
I honestly,
I think Mr. Hopkins is prepared to answer that question.
I'm trying to think about the policy, and I think you probably have a really good idea here, but my brain is hurting.
Right, right. Mr. Hopkins.
So, Madam Chair and members, so this is a reference to line 1.18 to 1.19 of the DE1 amendment. What this existing language is saying, it's a reference to FERPA, the Federal Education Privacy Law, which creates the ability of schools to designate directory information, because student information is protected both in Minnesota under our state Data Privacy Act and under the federal FERPA law. So what this is doing is it's saying directory information has to be designated pursuant to the provisions of, one, this subdivision, our state law, and two, FERPA. So it has to follow the federal rules. So these references to the U.S. Code and the Code of Federal Regulations are to FERPA and FERPA's implementing regulations regarding directory information.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. Representative Steer, did that clear it up for you?
No. I mean, is like I said, not in my wheelhouse, so if you think it's a good idea to add that in, I do think that asking a child or a student what your sexual behavior is not appropriate. If it covers it, I'm all for it.
Representative Feist.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question. I think this, I agree with you on the intent. I don't know that that is what we would want to do within the context of this bill, because all this site, which is, I always thought 20 USC was Department of Labor, but I don't know. Anyway, it's what it, all it's saying is that basically this is going to align and comply with other existing state and federal student privacy laws. And so I think that the site that you're referring to is outside of what we're trying to do here, but I would be totally interested in connecting with you to see if there is a way to, like, look at this really important federal policy and find ways to incorporate it into state law.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Feist and Representative Steer. I think it's this bill is about parent data. That's more on the student data level. But, yeah, you two should talk.
Mm-hmm.
So... Any other member questions? Seeing none, Representative Feist renews her motion that House File 101, as amended, be re-referred to the Education Policy Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way.
Thank you.
House File 1021 is the last bill on our agenda today. We will be laying the bill over. We have the bill before us. Chair Scott, would you like to move to bring the bill before us?
Yes, I will present. It's my pleasure to represent House File 1021. It is a bill that raises the amount designated for the statewide Minnesota Family Resiliency Partnership by $30 for each dissolution filing fee and $30 from each marriage license filing fee without premarital education. These amounts will not increase the overall filing fee for any of the applicants. This is the first adjustment to these fees in 22 years. And it's I'm looking forward to having our testifiers share with you the successes of their program. For 45-plus years, the Minnesota Family Resiliency Partnership, federally known as the Displaced Homemaker Program, has been a trusted pre-employment and family stabilization program provided by a network of six regional partners across the state. It's the only program in the state specifically designed to help displaced homemakers address the unique barriers they face while trying to enter or re-enter the workforce as they navigate a very personal loss due to death, disability, or divorce from a spouse or partner. According to the most recent data available, 73% of the displaced homemakers served by the program were victims of domestic violence. Of the participants with a child support order, 75% were not receiving the support as ordered by the court. This program serves a population facing multiple barriers to self-sufficiency. 96% of the participants are female. What makes this program unique is its holistic and client-driven approach. Participants are served through a combination of activities, including one-to-one self-sufficiency counseling, weekly workshop series that focus on life skills, needs assessments, and creation of individualized action plans. The program also helps participants identify and access resources that will make it possible for them to begin their journey towards self-sufficiency. These programs result in excellent outcomes. 97% of the participants successfully complete the program by attaining the goals they have set at intake, which include pursuing degree or certificate programs and or becoming employed. Those who exited programs as employed did so at an average wage of $20.38 an hour. These life-changing services are critical because those who participate in this program are often Minnesota's unseen, unemployed, or underemployed, who may not otherwise receive any services and would be ineligible for unemployment benefits. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Whichever of you would like to go first, just state your name and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jean Keenan. Thank you for this opportunity, and thank you, Chair Scott. The goal of the statewide Minnesota Family Resiliency Partnership, or MFRP, is to help participants achieve lasting self-sufficiency by interrupting the downward spiral often faced after the loss of a family's primary wage earner due to abandonment, divorce, disability, or death. This program has been helping people to change their lives for over 45 years and has long-time stable leadership with directors having 20-plus years of experience. Services are offered at no cost to participants, all of whom are at or below 200% of the federal poverty guideline. The six regional providers across the state offer effective, holistic, and client-driven services. Again, I think it is worth noting that 73% of program participants are survivors of domestic violence. 28% enter the program unhoused. 71% have dependents counting on them. Each individual works with a provider to develop a unique action plan, including a safety plan, essential transferable skills, and effective job search strategies. The program provides direct support dollars to help participants overcome incidental barriers to self-sufficiency. Most importantly, the program helps families to stabilize after a crisis by building a trusting relationship through trauma-informed care. Participants are eligible for services for up to 12 months, and in some cases, when necessary, even longer. We recognize that other bills have been introduced this session to use this same fee structure that was created specifically to ensure that our life-changing services would be available. We do not wish to be pitted against any other programs. Our guiding principle for nearly five decades has been that once survivors of domestic violence move toward economic self-sufficiency, they will at last have the very real option to not return to unsafe relationships out of economic need. As you see, funding for these services is authorized by statute and administered through deed from a portion of marriage license and divorce filing fees. The amount collected from these fees was the program's sole funding source from 1982 to 1992. In 2003, it was recommended that we return to the use of these fees as a funding source once again. This continues to the present, and as you've already heard, this amount has not been adjusted in the last 22 years. During a recent legislative session, there were no other bills requesting funding in this way, and thanks to this committee, the funding MFRP requested was included in the omnibus bill, which unfortunately didn't pass that year. The most recent calculation shows that the state realized a $26.89 to $1 return on its investment in the program by helping move people away from public assistance. Those who exited the program as employed did so at an average wage of $20.38 per hour. This unique program, since its inception, has always addressed both safety and self-sufficiency and therefore required a unique approach to funding. The individuals who need our services would not often otherwise receive services and would be ineligible for unemployment benefits. We have been good stewards of these funds over the years, and we are asking for your support of House File 1021. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Pilgrim, state your name and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, at the request, my name is Kimberly Pilgrim. At the request of Betty Rail, I'm here to share her story. Betty cannot be with us here today because she couldn't get off from work. Quote, I was a homemaker for 30 years and raised three children. One afternoon, my husband left for an appointment and he never returned. I was left isolated, grief-stricken, suicidal, and fearful. I did not have an income and had little experience with even driving a vehicle. I didn't know how to put gas in my car. I had no community support, and my grown children were living out of state. Someone told me about the Minnesota Family Resiliency Partnership Program, so I made an appointment. I was very afraid. I didn't even know how to put gas in my I was very afraid and to go in, and the director met me in the parking lot. I attended workshops that helped me manage grief, learn self-esteem, manage loss, life skills, and self-confidence. I also had the help of the other participants who taught me how to put gas in my car and treated me as family. The program supported me with car repairs, gas, clothing, food, and resources for food. At first, much of my time was one-on-one preparation, and I was gaining strength. At 53 years old, I knew I had to do something. With individual career planning, I decided to enroll in college in the administrative assistant program. While in college, I did work study in the family resiliency program and was given hands-on office skill training. I graduated from college with honors, and because I had gained such strength, I was fully prepared for employment. Within 3 months of graduation, I was interviewed and was offered a livable wage, and I now have great benefits. I would not have made it without this program. I urge you to recognize its profound impact and continue funding and supporting this vital initiative. The people who benefit from this program are not just statistics. We are survivors. And we are proof that with the right resources, a second chance at life is possible. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Is there any member discussion on this bill? Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Scott, for bringing this bill. I definitely support it.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing this bill. I definitely support it. And I was just curious to know how do you find your clients, and do you reach out proactively to domestic violence shelters or other advocacy programs in order to try to find people who might need your help?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's an excellent question. As a matter of fact, as I was sitting here waiting to testify and I was checking my email, we were getting a referral from our local domestic violence shelter so that we can move into that next phase. So we work with really any organization that makes a referral to us, specifically our domestic violence shelters. Additionally, and I'm very proud to say this, it's very old-fashioned, but a lot of our referral is word of mouth, which means someone's sister, cousin, friend, neighbor got excellent service, and they felt that it was really important to share that information.
Okay. Any other member discussion? Representative Mahmoud.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry if you went over this, but what sort of job training do you guys offer in your program?
Ms. Keenan.
Mr. Chair, member. So we really are very client-driven, and I think what makes our program kind of a unicorn is that there isn't we don't have a direction. We're not trying to approach people as a problem to be solved, but rather an asset to be cultivated. And so our goal is for them to do some assessments around what are my strengths, what are my abilities, where's my aptitude, and then to help them have agency to make a determination about where they might best apply their skills, while we're doing that, we always want to be mindful of what are those high-wage, high-demand jobs that are going to net people the best outcomes. But our goal is that people will reach a point of self-determination, particularly for victims of domestic violence who may have heard for a very long time that they were incapable of doing things, couldn't make good decisions, would never make it on their own. What they really need is that agency and determination to make some of their own decisions with some guidance about what are some of those jobs that would net a good income for them.
Representative Mahmoud.
Okay, just so I understand, are you saying then you do this assessment with them and then if they, let's say they want an office job as an assistant, you would help them develop those skills?
Ms. Keenan?
Mr. Chair, members, so the way we work at this is we operate as an external partner to the Workforce Center system. So we're doing really the pre-employment work, the sort of the preparing people to even job search, right? It's difficult to job search and to look for the skills that you're going to need if you're living in your car with two children. So we do those basic preparatory kinds of things that are required, and then we work with our external partners so that we're not duplicating services that can be available to people in other areas. But we'll be that soft handoff and do kind of that wraparound and holistic service.
Very good. Representative Mahmoud.
That's all. Thank you.
Any other member discussion on the bill? If not, before we go to your closed chair, Scott, I'd just like to say that considering what this program does, fully support it, but it is infuriating to realize why it's necessary. And I think us guys need to have a conversation about why it is that we're putting women in a position where they need to have these types of services provided for them by someone other than those of us who should be supporting them as partners. With that said, Chair Scott, please close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the testifiers for being here. And we have a lot of government agencies and a lot of programs and everything, and I think this program is one that we just get so much bang for our buck that I'm just highly supportive. So I hope that members can support.
Seeing no further discussion, the bill is laid over for possible inclusion. That concludes our business for today. The meeting is adjourned.